answering the objections from the non-believer, or sometimes even the believer, of TAG. Remember, to review briefly, the first objection is that TAG is not a unique form of argumentation. Remember, this is John Frame's criticism. There is no unique form that TAG presents. What it is basically a rhetorical difference from a direct argument. This argument is no different except rhetorically from the direct argument or the traditional arguments. We saw here the big confusion, for example, in John Frame's understanding of causation. The argument causation, therefore, God is about what? It's about the nature, given cause, what implications it has for some beginning. So it gives the unbeliever, it grants that the unbeliever understands the notion of causation, can use it, is justified in his arguments of it, and forces him to draw the conclusion that God exists. But it gives the unbeliever causation. Now, that's not the transcendental argument. We can argue transcendentally about causation, but it's a de jure argument. It's a question of right. We're going to argue that unless you presuppose the Christian God, then you don't have the right to even speak of causation. So John Frame is wrong about this criticism. Transcendental arguments, and in particular the transcendental argument, is quite different than the traditional arguments. And the second objection was that this argument, TAG, does not provide a uniqueness proof. Now we looked over that one in detail and showed that that's a misconception. And even when it's not misconstrued, that the objection that, well, you haven't given the impossibility of the contrary, you just given the impossibility of a contrary, is shown to be incorrect. Because what do? We don't simply take on Islam or naturalism, whatever it is, and once we refute that, say, therefore, the God of the Bible exists. We deny Christianity, right? Deny the ontological Trinity, deny the doctrines of our Christian religion, and show that once you do that, then it is impossible to make sense of human experience. And therefore, we have proved what Van Til called the impossibility of the contrary. So we do have a uniqueness proof. We show that not one version or several versions of the non-Christian worldview are false. We show that the non-Christian worldview is false. And in the process, we show that the Christian worldview is true. If the negation of Christianity is impossible, then Christianity is necessary. The third objection was about the mere sufficiency of the Christian worldview. Remember, this was the Christian business, that we can simply take Christianity, make a few tweaks in it, and then come up with a worldview that does give us sufficient grounds to justify our experiences. We saw the spurious nature of this from two points of view. One is, you cannot take away any aspect of the Christian religion and maintain the same religion, nor add anything. And they say, that's okay, it's not quite the same. We're going to have something different. But once you do that, now you have to either produce a systematic theology to explain how changing one small doctrine like the ontological Trinity from a trinity to a quadrinity, for example, how that affects every area of your theology. That's not done. But even if it were done, it's not going to matter because it's not going to be able to provide the preconditions of human experience, because Christianity claims that it alone provides the preconditions of human experience. It alone is true and necessary. God is necessarily true. Not a God, but the God of the Bible. So if the God of the Bible and the religion that he delivers us to us is a sufficient precondition for human experience, then it must also be a necessary condition for human experience. Because if it's not necessarily true, Christianity is necessarily false. And finally, the fourth objection we've been talking about, remember now, this is the most heady one. It's the one that's least used, but it's the best one of them. And that is, the non-believer could, or the objector of TAG, could come and say, look, there's a distinction between proving the conceptual necessity of the Christian worldview versus the actual existence of God, versus proving that God exists. Right? So we drew a distinction. Now, it's a razor-thin distinction at one point, right? Remember, if this is all he has to go on, if his last gambit is simply, look, you prove that we can not explain anything without presupposing Christianity, but that still doesn't prove that God exists, right? And let's say that argument was coherent and legitimate, then he still doesn't have much, does he? Right? We've done what Dr. Bonson says we must do. We have shut the mouth of the unbeliever. We have answered the fool according to his folly. We have shown that if you want to be rational, if you want to have science or whatever it is, then you have to presuppose the Christian worldview. We've done a lot by just doing this. In fact, you may argue that we've done everything we need to do. And so this objection really has very little teeth to it. However, there's still something there that deserves us to look into, because it says that you haven't proved the Christian God exists. Remember, this is very much a Kantian type of criticism. You've shown that the conceptual scheme of Christianity is the case, but you haven't shown that what Christianity speaks of is the case. Right? Remember the phenomenal noumenal distinction. Kant says we must think of objects as being in space and in time. If you conceive of an object, it must be the case that it is in space or in time. Okay? It cannot be conceived otherwise. And Kant's further point is what? That doesn't mean that objects are indeed in space and time. It just means we must conceptualize the world in a certain way. So this objection is very much like that position by Kant. So let's look at this objection once again. The contention that the move from conceptual necessity to necessary existence is unwarranted, that's the fourth objection. It is clear that much of the contemporary literature on transcendental arguments is relevant to our argument, the transcendental argument for God's existence. Now, remember, I skipped over the middle part of the essay where I talk about the modern philosophers and their discussion of transcendental arguments, but you won't need to know that for what we're talking about, what I'm going to be talking about here. The challenge is thus to bridge the gap between having to believe the Christian worldview because it provides the necessary preconditions of experience and showing that the Christian worldview is in fact true. Okay, that's what we need to bridge the gap of. One of the distinctions made by a philosopher is between what he calls option A and option B, transcendental arguments. Recall that Bonson's response to this objection, this fourth objection, was that the debate between the Christian and the non-Christian assumes that one of the views has to be true. While this may be indeed the assumption between opponents in the debate, Bonson provides us with little reason for why this assumption is correct. Now, it doesn't mean that he couldn't have, but he doesn't provide us in his writings why it must be correct. Therefore, without an argument for this contentious assumption, Bonson seems to be forced to construe TAG as an option B, transcendental argument. Now, the distinction between an option A and an option B is that an option A transcendental argument is a transcendental argument that has an ontological conclusion. And what's an ontological conclusion? You can also call it an existential conclusion. And what does that mean? An ontological conclusion, ontology talks about something that exists, right? Something that exists. And so option A transcendental arguments talk about some object that exists, or an existential conclusion. Now, the option B transcendental arguments conclude that some conceptual scheme or some aspect of a conceptual scheme must be employed in order to provide the conditions to some area, or in the case of TAG, all areas of human experience. And so it would seem, taking this distinction made by this philosopher and some of what Bonson says, that we can construe Dr. Bonson's argument is an option B transcendental argument. The Christian worldview is shown to be the necessary precondition for experience in general and the necessary precondition for rationality in particular. To deny Christianity, a move that presupposes rationality, is to presuppose Christianity. Right? Dr. Bonson, if you're familiar with his lectures, used to say that a lot. Denial of atheism, he said, presupposes what? Theism, right? To deny Christian theism, presupposes Christian theism. Why? Because Christianity provides a precondition for logic, and so if you're going to deny Christian theism, you need to use logic, but you're already presupposing it to begin with. So Christianity is true whether which way you go. So atheism presupposes theism. If TAG does show that we must believe in Christianity in order to make our experience possible, this is a powerful apologetic tool in itself. The problem, though, is that while TAG and an option B interpretation demonstrates that the Christian worldview is the necessary precondition for experience, it does not prove that the Christian worldview is true. For it may be that our experience of rationality, morality, science, and so on are illusory. Bonson's reply to Montgomery that we must make the gratuitous assumption that at least one worldview must be right is problematic at this point. Not when his criticism of Montgomery was right there. Right, but maybe if it's simply an option B transcendental argument, where we're simply showing the conceptual necessity of presupposing a certain conceptual scheme, a certain worldview, then it leaves open the possibility that though we must think of the world in such a way, doesn't necessarily mean the world is indeed such a way. One way out of this predicament is to make the strong modal claim that the world is actually rational, that universals exist, that our sensory faculties do get us in touch with the external world, and so on. Right? So you make the claim that we in fact do get in touch with reality. We in fact are rational, ultimately. We in fact have morality. Right? That's going to take strong argument itself. Given this premise, it can readily be shown that TAG does get us from the truth to the truth of Christianity. For if the necessary precondition of experience is the Christian worldview, and if our experience must be of a real, mind-independent world, this conclusion follows immediately. The problem, of course, is how to prove such a strong modal claim. How are we going to prove that? Certainly, this cannot be achieved by using contemporary transcendental arguments. For some philosophers have shown that such arguments need either an additional factual premise or a principle of verification in order to work. You're not going to understand that as it stands, but let's skip over that. Take my word for that one. It's going to be more difficult to prove these strong modal claims. You know what a modal claim is? Modal logic deals with possibility, impossibility, and necessity. In order for the option B form of the transcendental argument to work, meaning to get it to conclude that God exists, not just that you need to presuppose Christianity, what you need are strong modal claims about the world. And that means you have to prove that the world is necessarily rational, that the world is necessarily, that our experience is necessarily reliable, that morality is necessarily that there is such a thing as morality necessarily. Now, of course, we know that to be the case, but to argue that independently from our transcendental argument is going to be something that is going to probably not be able to be accomplished, right? Because it seems to imply that we're going to have to argue that apart from the Christian worldview. Because if we use the Christian worldview, that's going to be question begging. If we don't use the Christian worldview, it's going to be seemingly impossible. So it seems we have a problem here. There is another way around this problem, though. If, as some have maintained, Van Til was something of an idealist, which is not true, okay, he's not an idealist, but some have claimed that for some of the things he writes. People misunderstand what he writes. Van Til is not an idealist, but I'm speaking, again, counterfactually. If it's true what these people that get it wrong say about Van Til is right, if he was something of an idealist, we can see how he was able to bridge the gap between thought and reality, right? If you've got your philosophical thinking cap on, if somebody holds to an option B type of transcendental argument, arguing for the conceptual necessity of some conceptual scheme, and if that person is an idealist, then necessarily that conclusion is going to have existential import, right? It's going to be necessarily not only necessary, we not only need to think that way, but it's necessarily true. Because there's no gap in idealism between what? Thought and reality. Okay, so if Van Til were an idealist, argued option B transcendental arguments, then there's no gap to bridge. The argument goes through. It's a valid argument, sound argument. He's proved the truth of Christianity. This reading of Van Til, however, is not only implausible, but there's nothing in his writings to indicate that he relied upon some version of idealism to make the move from what we must believe to what the world is like. I must confess here, at the time I was more influenced by academies than I am now. Right? Academies is the way you write, with always qualifying, always being careful. Van Til is not an idealist. It's not that there doesn't seem to be any evidence that he was an idealist. He was an idealist. You live and learn. Right? I was young when I wrote this, forgive me. Van Til is not an idealist. Furthermore, even if Van Til were an idealist, this would be of little help to the Christian who, like Bahnsen, is an epistemological realist, right? Or to Christians in general. Christianity does not teach idealism, even though somebody like Jonathan Edwards, and my reading is very much an idealist, and I have great respect for Edwards, and it's quite fascinating, but it's not a Christian, ultimately a Christian biblical position. That's, of course, not calling into anything, any question about Jonathan Edwards, just that I think that he had some major problems there. But the major problem with this move is that Christian theology and idealistic metaphysics are fundamentally at odds with one another. So this isn't going to work. So if it's an option B argument, it would be helpful if Christianity taught idealism because there would be no gap to bridge and that we would prove the truth of Christianity. But Christianity does not teach idealism. It is difficult to see a way through this predicament now. All exits seem to be blocked off, and it appears that the Christian apologist is forced to conceive of TAG as an option B, transcendental argument. And as such, the claim that TAG proves the existence of God can no longer be made. Understand this, right? If this argument goes through, if this is a valid criticism of TAG, then we can no longer maintain that Christianity is necessarily true. We must merely maintain that we must think, if we are to understand the world, as Christians. We must presuppose Christianity in order to understand the world. That's a strong claim, but it's not the same thing as maintaining that God necessarily exists. This seriously diminishes the force of TAG. It seems that the best the presuppositionalists can do at this point is to argue that the most likely explanation for the fact that the Christian worldview is a necessary precondition for experience is that Christianity is true. This is often called the argument to the best explanation by philosophers. Right? This doesn't show that Christianity is true, but why is it that Christianity alone can account for our experience? Well, one explanation is that it is true. Right? One explanation for the fact that Christianity and Christianity alone can make sense of our experience is that isn't true. Right? Now, that's a reasonable consideration, but it still doesn't get us to what? Necessity. But notice that even if this is granted, that Christianity is the truth of it is the most likely explanation, the argument for God's existence is reduced to one of a probability claim. You must think, presuppose Christianity, and the reason that this is the case is it's most likely true, that's still a probabilistic argument. Now, we're far away from the old resurrection argument type of probabilism, right? This is far from that. But still, it seems that you're back in some degree of probability here. So if it's granted, the argument for God's existence is reduced to one of a probability claim. And if it is probable or even highly probable that God exists, right? If it's highly probable but not necessary that God exists, it follows that there is some possibility that he does not exist, even if the probability is almost nil. Before we abandon hope, there may be a way out of this problem. The source of the present difficulty seems to be the way in which the tag has been set up. Given the context of this discussion, the tendency is to conflate the notion of the Christian worldview with the notion of a conceptual scheme. Okay, this is where I think the problem really lies. It's viewing the Christian worldview as really a conceptual scheme. Now, what is a conceptual scheme? Conceptual scheme is some conception of our experience that comes in a systematic way. So we think of the Copernican conceptual scheme. And that is viewing the world, right? We look out at the stars and the planets tonight, and during the day, the sun, and we view them as what? View them as objects that, if it's a sun, that we are traveling around, or if it's stars, planets, objects we are traveling with around the sun. Right? You can conceptualize it that way. Now, in a sense, we don't really do that. We still have the old way of doing it. But we think of it as we're traveling with the planets around the sun. Now, in the old theory, you conceptualize the relation of the Earth, planets, and sun as very different. The sun was going around the Earth. The planets were going around the Earth, as well as the stars and the heavenlies. And so we look today and see the same information our ancestors did. We see the same thing, but we conceive of it differently. Let me give you an example from psychology. Some of you have seen this before. If you've seen it, zip it. Don't say anything. Somebody tell me what that is. Oh, is that that bad? It's not supposed to be. Rabbit head. Anybody see anything different? Duck. Oh, yes. Right. This is an example. The Gestalt psychologists like to use examples like this. Now, can you see a rabbit? Try to look there and see a rabbit. Can you see it? Okay, now try to see the duck. Can you see that? Okay, now this is a very low-level way of conceptualizing something, but you can control how you view this thing. What remains the same? My beautiful drawing remains the same, right? But the way you approach it differs. You see the same thing, but you conceptualize it differently. Okay, now a conceptual scheme is something like this. Of course, it's much more rich than this. The way you conceptualize something is going to determine what you think of that thing, right? So you see a rabbit or duck depending upon, to a certain degree, what you bring to it. You see the stars at night and the sun in the day. You can conceptualize it differently than our ancestors did, and we, in fact, do conceptualize it differently. Now, the conceptual scheme is something like a Copernican view of the heavens or an Aristotelian view of the heavens, something like that. It's a way of conceiving of a certain aspect of our experience. Now, all that to say is, this objection, I believe, conflates a worldview with something called a conceptual scheme. But a conceptual scheme and a worldview are quite different. We can conceptualize the world differently without necessarily changing essential elements of our worldview. Our worldviews are much richer. Our worldviews commit us ontologically to things, whereas conceptualization doesn't necessarily commit us to foundational ontological commitments. Okay, so back here. Given the context of the discussion, the tendency is to conflate the notion of the Christian worldview with the notion of a conceptual scheme. Although there is a certain surface similarity between the two, right? I mean, we can talk about the different name that philosophers have. Conceptual schemes, worldviews, webs of belief, language games, forms of life. You've all heard of these different things, right? Paradigms. So we could be sloppy about it and think, well, they all mean the same thing. And I think this objection trades on that sloppiness. They're not the same thing. There's a certain surface similarity between the two, conceptual scheme and worldview. These two notions do not, in fact, correspond to one another. It is a serious error to conceive of the Christian worldview as nothing more than a mere conceptual scheme that organizes our experience. Christianity certainly does that much, right? We're not going to deny that Christianity organizes our experience, the Christian worldview organizes our experience, that's a given. Christianity, in some sense, organizes our experience, but it does more than this. The Christian worldview is much richer than the conceptual scheme that it is the precondition of, say, re-identifying particulars. I'm referring to something back earlier. My point here is, without wanting to explain this, is that Christianity is much more, the Christian worldview is much more developed, has more commitments, richer than a conceptual scheme of something like Kant's are necessarily having to perceive objects in a spatio-temporal continuum. Right? And that is only organizing a very limited, though important, right? Our experience of objects, important but very limited aspect of our experience. The Christian worldview is not delimited in any way. It organizes everything conceivable. And so they're not on the same level. Christianity provides us with a detailed, metaphysical, epistemological, and ethical system. The foundation of the system is an absolute, personal, triune God who has created all things, including man. This God, moreover, has given man his word so that he may, man that is, man may know the truth that God gives him. The Christian worldview, thus, not only provides a way to organize experience, but it tells us that a sovereign God has revealed truths about the world to us and gives us knowledge of what? All possible experience. Stated another way, the necessity of a conceptual scheme cannot guarantee anything about the way the world must be. For while such a scheme may organize our experience, it is itself dumb and mute and cannot, definitionally, tell us anything about the world itself. Conceptual schemes do not speak. Right? They're mute, they're deaf, they're dumb. But the Christian worldview, the Christian worldview is not a mere conceptual scheme. It claims to do more than simply provide us with the necessary preconditions of experience. The Christian worldview posits a sovereign creator God who is both personal and absolute. He is a speaking God, moreover, who reveals truths to us about himself and the world. In his revelation to us, he declares that he has made the world, and this world exists independently from himself and us. On the basis of his revelation, therefore, which is itself the necessary precondition of experience, we can know truths about the world and God. Okay, so this objection tries to show that we can't say that Christianity is true because that goes beyond the purview of the argument. This is an option B argument, not an option A argument. The comeback is, no, it is indeed an option A argument because the necessary precondition of human experience is a Christian worldview, and that's not a mere conceptual scheme. That's not a way of organizing this or that experience. It is a worldview that encompasses every aspect of life that entails ontological commitments, and so if you argue for it that it's true, then the ontological commitments involved in it must likewise be the case. Okay, now, we've gone over the major arguments against the transcendental argument for God's existence. Now, there's going to be more debate on this issue. This is a big topic, but I want to give you at least some overview, especially the seminary students. Right? Some of you other ones are glad this part is over with. Right? But this is something that you're going to deal with if you're interested in pursuing presuppositional apologetics, because right now, the big attack on presuppositionalism is at this point. There are many people that are arguing that Fantillianism is incorrect because of this point. What I've tried to do is provide you with at least a basic answer to the major objections to the transcendental argument for God's existence. Okay, transition time. Any questions so far? There we go. Well, it doesn't have to be personal, and we can all share a conceptual scheme. We can all share Copernicanism, right, which we do, I hope. So we all view that the sun is the center of our solar system. So we share that conceptual scheme. But we can't, that doesn't, the problem with conflating a conceptual scheme with the worldview, one of the problems is that the conceptual scheme is something limited. That one, for example, is only organizing some very, very minor aspect of our experience. A worldview is one that organizes all of our experience and makes ontological claims to boot. And so they're not on the same level. Right, I'll put it another way. Here, Christianity is not just a worldview, if you construe a worldview as a conceptual scheme, which is not the way to conceive of it. And Christianity teaches that, not that there, if there were a God, we can explain certain things, but there is a God. Christianity, in other words, is not some conception of the way in which the world exists. It is giving us claims about the way the world is. Okay, the way the world is, the way that God is, and therefore it is not just something that we can conceive of things, not just merely a way that we can conceive of things. Okay, any more questions? Let's do something easier. Aerobics. No, we won't do aerobics. Okay, we're on now. We're coming to the home stretch, aren't we? We're on Roman numeral 9. Roman numeral 9, alternative methodologies to presuppositionalism. Now, we'll save Clarkianism and Reformed epistemology for tomorrow. We'll pick on the evidentialist tonight. He's easy to pick on, isn't he? So what is evidentialism? Now, first of all, why should we talk about various schools? Remember, we're back now at the level of, not apologetics, but meta-apologetics, right? We're talking about apologetics. What is the correct method of apologetics? Well, this week we've been concerned with biblical presuppositional apologetics, but as you all are aware, there are alternative theories out there. One of which, the most famous of which, or that you're probably most aware of, is called evidentialism. Evidentialism. Now, as you can see from the root, evidential, evidence, this has to do with evidence, right? How do we establish Christianity or make arguments for Christianity on the basis of evidence? A famous book written in the early 70s, maybe in the late 60s, was by Josh McDowell, was called Evidence That Demands a Verdict, right? Evidence. Here's the evidence, and now you decide, right? You decide. It demands a verdict, and you're the one that's going to decide it. Well, what does evidentialism teach in more details? It teaches us that the way in which we justify claims is by means of evidence. Not in terms of transcendental reasoning, not in terms typically of logical proofs, but in terms of evidence. Now, evidentialism is not simply a Christian apologetic position, although most Christians think of it that way. Evidentialism is an epistemological theory that has its roots in typically what's called foundationalism or classical foundationalism. We'll talk more about this tomorrow when we talk about Alvin Plantinga and Reformed epistemology. But evidence grounded in a particular way of viewing what counts as justification, often rooted in what's called foundationalism. So the evidence, the way in which you justify your claims to truth or your claims of knowledge, is that you provide evidence for them. Now, we've mentioned a number of the traditional evidential arguments. The most famous is probably the argument for the resurrection of Christ. So let's spend a little time on it, because evidentialism isn't something that's very difficult to understand itself. Right? I mean, how many of you held to some version of evidentialism at one point in your Christian experience? All the Johnson boys I see. Okay, we're going to talk to Pastor Johnson afterwards. No, I'm just kidding. Some of us, right? I did. Pastor Johnson did, right? And unless you're raised in a Presbyterian home, chances are that you have held to something like that. Okay, now, remember, we're dealing with fellow Christians at this point. Evidentialism is broader than the Christian one. We're talking about now the Christian evidentialists, and Let's always be careful. We're arguing against, criticizing theories, methods, not people. Right? I have high regard. I've met Josh McDowell. He seems to be a good guy. I don't agree with him on most things, but he's a nice guy. Now, what is their famous argument? They offer many, but the famous one is the resurrection argument. So let's construct it. How does it go? Well, the conclusion is what? What are they trying to argue for? That Jesus Christ rose from the dead. Now, what are some of the evidences that are given by the evidentialists to drive us to that conclusion? Anybody want to add some things? What are they? Empty tomb. How about that one? The tomb is empty. How about the changed life of lives of the apostles? Right. What did Peter do the night before Jesus went to the cross? The night of the trial. What happened? He denied him twice. Once to a little girl, didn't he? To a little girl, I do not know him. Yo. But within 50 days or so, a little over 40 days, what happens? He's standing in front of the Jewish leaders and proclaiming the resurrected Christ. Something happened to Peter. He changed. The other disciples were, what? Hiding away. Right? But after the resurrection, they preached boldly and went on to do what? Overturn the world. Right? They went on to transform the world. Big change went on. Okay, so the changed life of the disciples. What else? Well, when you talk about the empty tomb, we could say more to it than about it than that, can't we? Empty tomb, but maybe the body was stolen. Right? But the evidence says no, couldn't have been stolen. Or not likely that it was stolen. Why not? Guards posted there. There were seals. Right? And the stone was over it. And I'm not sure how biblical scholars know this, but I'll take the word for it. I've heard that they're about 2,000 pounds, these stones. I guess we know by comparing them to other stones. But if that's true, that's a big stone to move away, isn't it? 2,000 pounds. I mean, it would take both of my arms to do it. So who's going to throw open this tomb that is sealed with the Roman insignia, which if you break without authorization is what? Death. And a guard posted there. Well, that's Evan, but that tomb is empty. Moreover, you can say, well, maybe somebody stole the body. They did get past all that and stole the body anyways. Well, if they did, right? Or excuse me, I'm confusing something. What if they went to the wrong grave, the wrong tomb? Well, then the Jews would have produced the body and say, he didn't raise from the dead. Here's his body. Right? So the evidentialist shows that the evidence is that the tomb is empty, the disciples' lives were changed, and we can add, I'm sure I'm forgetting many things, they can add lots of different evidence to this. And they conclude that Jesus rose from the dead. Not quite, right? Did they conclude that Jesus rose from the dead? No. What did they conclude? He probably did. In fact, very probably did. Now, right there, we got to stop, right? Be prepared. Sanctify Christ as Lord your heart. Always be ready. Be prepared to give an account, to give a apologetic of the hope that it was in you, yet with gentleness and reverence. Given hope. Give an account of the hope. My hope is in nothing less than the probability of Jesus' success, right? The probability of the resurrection is highly likely. Okay? The Bible talks of what? The certainty of salvation. And if we know we're saved, then we know what? What comes before that is Jesus rose from the dead. We know that. Right? How can we know we were saved if we didn't know that Jesus rose from the dead? Now, you may hear at this point some of the more sophisticated evidentials making the distinction between what? Objective certainty and subjective certainty. Okay, now we're in trouble, right? I like distinctions, but I like distinctions that make a difference. Right? Subjective certainty. There is a distinction between objective certainty and subjective certainty, if what you mean by it is somebody feeling, I know this is the case, right? Versus something that really is the case, and you're certain of it because you have certain proof. So there is a distinction. But is that really relevant to this, the biblical teaching of being certain of our salvation? I feel subjectively certain that I'm a Christian. I can know I'm a Christian. I know I'm a Christian subjectively because I feel it subjectively. Well, that's ridiculous, isn't it? That's what the Bible teaches. It doesn't teach us a subjective certainty. Now, it does teach that we have certainly, and that in some sense is subjective because it's not really a feeling, but it's something that we possess. But certainty cannot be merely something that we have as a feeling. Okay? There is an objective nature to it. And so the disciples aren't just teaching in the Gospels, and Jesus isn't teaching, the disciples in their the epistles, and Jesus teaching in the Gospels that you can be confident subjectively that you're a Christian. No, you can know that you're a Christian. So that's not going to get them anywhere. So they teach that there is a high probability that Jesus rose from the dead. That's not a biblical apologetic without saying anything more, is it? That's not biblical because Christianity teaches much more than probability. Now, if the evidentialist then says, well, yes, on the basis of evidence, we can be it's highly probable that Jesus rose from the dead. But we also know as Christians that Jesus rose from the dead because God's word tells us. Well, what do we say to that? We say, well, we agree with you on the second part, right? Right. God's word does tell us, and that's why we know that Jesus rose from the dead. But now you are a presuppositionalist. That's not evidentialism anymore. So if the evidentialist wants to rely on the Bible, then he's no longer an evidentialist. So he has to say it's highly likely, probable. But if it's highly likely and probable, then it is also probable or very unlikely, but it's possible that Jesus didn't rise from the dead. And therefore what? This is a compromised apologetic just on this ground alone. Well, what else can we say about presuppositionalism? Evidentialism. If I start speaking in tongues, just stop me, okay? So what else can we say against it? Well, it tells us that the evidence points to their conclusion that Jesus rose from the dead. Now, we did this a little before, but let's do it in a little more detail as a reveal. What can we say about their evidence? What can we say about the evidentialist claim that, for example, the disciples' lives were changed, and therefore that gives us good grounds to believe that Jesus rose from the dead, was the empowering, sent his empowering spirit to them and caused them to lead new lives? What can we say to that? Answer over here? No? I saw a hand up over here. We could say to that, well, they may have believed Jesus rose from the dead. And we know that beliefs can be very powerful psychologically. People believing certain things can actually change the way they behave, can't they? Right? Many psychological theories use this insight, right? Many psychological theories try to get people to change their beliefs in order to do what? Change their practices. Now, the thing about those psychologists is they don't care whether those beliefs are true or not, right? They just know that beliefs are powerful things. And if you get people to believe certain things, you may get them to change their behavior in a desirable way or whatever you want to call it. So maybe the disciples thought that Jesus rose from the dead and that changed their lives. Well, why would they think that? You know, they weren't crazy after all, right? If they're going to say that Jesus rose from the dead, they had to at least, if their lives are going to be changed because of their belief, they had to at least believe it. And why would they believe it? Well, the most likely answer is that Jesus did rise from the dead. They saw him. But is that the only possibility? Is it necessarily the case that because they all together believe that he rose from the dead, that Jesus in fact did rise from the dead? Well, have you ever heard of group psychosis or group experiences that you get yourselves to believe certain things in a group? Right? We have psychologists that have studied the psychology of mobs. And when mobs get together, weird things happen. Right? As individuals, right, we're checked by certain things. But once we get in a large group, especially when somebody can manipulate the mob by means of speeches or images or things like that, weird things start to happen. You know, goose-stepping may happen, right? I mean, things may happen at that point. Now, we have disciples that are what? That are crushed, right? The Messiah, the one that they thought was the consolation of Israel, is in the tomb. They're holding together, right? They don't know what to think, right? They are in a state of great disturbance. And then, it may be, what if somebody suggested? Hey, I saw Jesus. And then it got hold of them, right? Now, I'm just giving you all this to show that this is a possibility, isn't it? There is a possibility that that happened. Okay, so it's not true that just because they believe that Jesus rose from the dead, that he did rise from the dead. They could have got themselves into such a frenzy that they got themselves to believe this thing. It was too psychologically painful for them to accept Jesus is still in the tomb. They ended up collectively coming to the conclusion that he rose from the dead. Okay, so that's possible, isn't it?